Hello and welcome to the Pedophile Huntress. We're here to discuss and normalize the hard discussions around the crimes of childhood sexual abuse. Society avoids what we will address and face head on here in these discussions. With me tonight is Carol Boyce. She's the author of First, I Believe You. It's a fantastic book. You should get it. If you're also interested in hearing her story, she's been on the podcast before, and her full interview is available in an earlier episode. We have one goal tonight together being here. We just hope that we can help your pain. We can bring some understanding to your broken heart and set you on a freer path than you have been before. I found this interesting statistic that I wanted to open the show with tonight. In the United States, between 1980 and 2022, around 15% of families reported to have had an event of incest in the family. But here's the interesting part. While 46% of rape victims who were children were raped by someone in their own family. So how can those numbers be the same? 15%. Of families report, but 45% of rape victims that are children, 45% were a family member. Isn't that wild? And yes. So I guess I'm just here to say that these are colonies of darkness. I don't like saying that. I don't like saying that I came from darkness. But again, we ended last show with, if you're in those colonies, get out. It's so important. We don't like saying it, but it's certainly true. Tonight, our discussion is going to be around submission or child compliance, because that's really what it is. We're going to talk about what grooming looks like when it's our parents, because it definitely feels and sounds very much like parenting to us as well, but it's detrimental in our lives, and how that submission damages our ability to seek help, to talk, to tell our stories, and actually to even remember our stories. And then we're going to end with kind of sexuality with trauma and how that submission carried with us into adulthood and how that formed the choices that we made or didn't make in our relationships. So I thought it would be good to start with a story tonight. It kind of sets the stage for what we're talking about. My daughter and I write a blog together, and she wrote this blog called Breaking Up is Hard to Do. And she's talking about exposing secrets in the family. And she writes, I remember showing up to a funeral, some distant relative who I'd never met, and encountering my grandfather. I was 14 at the time and completely aware of what he had done to my mother. Up until this point, we didn't have much contact with any of the grandparents. But almost as soon as my mother made eye contact with her father, she was bringing him pie, laughing at his jokes, and seemed to be on some eerie autopilot that nobody could turn off. I was flabbergasted, I was angry, and I was triggered. So, trauma bonds, Carol. Right? Isn't that just what she talked about? And I remember that day so clearly. I was 35. I'm almost 60. I am so far from that time, but I have to tell you, even if my father were to walk in this room right now, I'd probably get up and hug him, because it is so built into the fabric of how they raised us. So let's just open it up. I want to start with you. What did that, isn't that just a perfect thing? Weren't we always on autopilot? And then when did we come off of autopilot? About 50 years later, right?
Well, I think it really shows the complexity of these relationships. I mean, it's just unbelievable to have this person that many times you just dearly love. I mean, I very much respected my father and really loved him. And of course, I had no memory of what he was doing to me until I was 36. So, you know, the whole thing is so confusing, but I certainly hugged him if he ever wanted to. It wasn't a real warm kind of huggy person. Our family wasn't really like that. But yeah, you go on autopilot and do what you've been taught, you know.
You do. And so what did some of the grooming, how does grooming look different, right? So we understand the autopilot. Talk to us a little bit. I love Carol sent me this. I asked her, what are some things that we could talk about? And she said, let's talk about what grooming looks like when it's our parents. And indeed, it's very different. So what are some of those things that could look like parenting, but are really grooming in our case?
Yeah, interesting comparison. Yeah, they're parenting. And I think, you know, in my case, it was, I was very complicit. I mean, if they said jump, I said how high. It was certainly that kind of an environment where, you know, grooming was just being a child that did what they were told and were not, you know, outliers and acting out. And, you know, my siblings did a whole lot more of that. And, you know, I think they just did not have this terror in them like I had. So,
right.
How about
So,
you?
well, so fear of punishment is right. What
Yes.
I hear you saying, fear of punishment.
Yes.
Some of the things that I thought about were even deeper still. My compliance was actually because I wanted him to be happy. The way that my father really groomed me, and I think that I was kind of compliant, and you seem like you have some of this personality as well. Although I really do have a peppery side to me, ask my husband. But I don't know how much I was allowed to be who I was as a child. And so a huge part of my compliance was, number one, I didn't have a choice. And that's very clear. And I would have been punished. So I do think fear of punishment is first. But then I also think you talked about, and I know people listening are thinking she loved her father. I mean, you loved your father. But when you're a child, the only thing that we know is what they're giving to us. So they are the person who feeds us. They are the person who gave
Yes.
us life. They are the person that opens the door for us to go into our home, to eat and take baths and watch movies. Of course we loved them. But people have such a hard time with that. And so the way that my love played out and this grooming played out was my father, I hated my father to be unhappy with me. Now, I know my husband hated that too with his dad, but I don't think in his case it was exactly the same. So unfortunately, that really sets us up for it's grooming in our case, right? So,
yes.
I mean, I never received any attention from my father outside of his grooming. And that sounds, you know, it sounds drastic, but if you think about it, I mean, he didn't play games with anybody else. Did he rape everybody else as often as he was raping me? Probably not. He didn't play games with them. I got to sit on the couch next to him and eat popcorn while we watched movies. Was that a loving gesture? I don't think so. He'd rub my leg. You know what I mean? So beyond the fear of punishment, they build this relationship in you, just as a parent does with another child, right? So the complication is that these stereotypes of parenting that are good become very negative with us, right? All right, so here is Kevin Boyd. You guys, we're going to welcome Kevin Boyd right now. He's joining us.
Great.
So we're going to stop for just a minute and let Kevin come in. Here is Kevin. Kevin, we are to introduce Kevin Boyd. He has written a book and has his own help. He has the same goal that we do to help the brokenhearted and, you know, set you all on a road of freedom. Kevin, tell us what your book is. Your book is called...
My book, first of all, thank you for having me. Greetings,
yes,
everyone.
You're so welcome.
My book is called Blessings in Freedom. And there's a whole lot in that title. And so basically the premise is coming out of the victim mentality and knowing that your past doesn't have to define your future. So, you know, all the strongholds and chains you know, all the things that had me locked up, you know, I found the freedom in Jesus Christ to, you know, to rise above all the unfortunate circumstances and walk in victory.
Yes. So one of the things actually that I did want to say now that Kevin has joined is each one of the panelists on tonight, our fathers were our abusers. We did come through incest. And I think the underbelly of incest is the parental figure being the father. Obviously, right after that is the mother. I've looked at statistics about that. But Kevin, to bring you into the conversation, we're talking about submission or child compliance. And is that willing or is it coerced? And I think one of the things that we were just discussing is what looks like parenting in a normal household looks like grooming in a house of incest. And as a result of that, all we do is walk around complying. Or I remember in your case, Kevin, you stayed gone from the home. And again, Kevin's full story, he's also been on the podcast and his full story is available as well in a different podcast. But I remember saying that you stayed home, but we were just chatting about what does grooming look like when it's your father? Kevin, can you talk about that?
Well, I think grooming is the same principle in any of the abusers. Typically, unless you're like kidnapped off the street or something, they don't typically go full force, full Monty on the, you know, the onset of planning it in their mind that they're going to do it. They start out with petting or rubbing or touching or even supplanting thoughts in your head. Oh, you're pretty. Oh, you got a nice butt. You know, I mean.
Yeah, I remember that. My father saying that.
The options are endless, but I think, you know, come sit on grandpa's lap. You know what I mean? I mean, there's so many ways that you can open that door. But for me, I remember I was sick. I remember like it was yesterday. I was 5 years old and I had an excruciating fever, an excruciating headache. And I was so sick that I had to go home from school. My mother was a school teacher. So she, of course, she wasn't elementary school. She wasn't home during the day. So I had no choice but to spend the day with my dad. I was glad. I was really happy because my father wasn't really the nurturing type. So to spend the day with him was like a highlight. I get to spend time with my dad, which I never do, one-on-one. I did have an older brother. But nonetheless, I was so sick that I literally, now this he did not plan. I was so sick that I was burning up, so he had to take my clothes off because I was drenched in sweat. So that part, it was not his fault, but I think he used that as an open door to say, I'm going to get this little boy naked and I'm going to, you know, send him, you know, steer him in the direction I want him to go. So initially, the very initiation of it was, now that I'm new, lay on top of daddy. And even at 5 years old, I just said something, you know, you can't put it in words.
Right.
But in my spirit, it was like a yin and a yang because I was excited and I felt, I don't know if I want to say wanted, needed, but I felt something. You know, spending time with my dad, but at the same time, I felt awkward because I said, I don't think I'm supposed to be laying on top of my dad new, but I just dismissed it. What do I know? I'm a kid. So maybe it is normal. Maybe it is okay. You know what I mean?
And so, yes, absolutely.
For a period of time, that's when the grooming started. It started out like that. Then it was rub this, touch this, and you know the rest.
It grows, right? You know, I think that that's really important. It's right before you came on and joined us. One of the things that we were talking about, they think that we comply only out of fear of punishment, but the truth is they build this wanting. We want their love. We want their time. Yeah. We want their affection like any child would. And so it's so sad that in our case to respond to those needs was incredibly damaging. And so I do think there is mystery around, I like that you say grooming looks the same, but when it's your parent, it's very confusing. It's more complicated than if you go across the street to a stranger's house, right? But you know what I just read you guys? Over 90% of cases are not strange. It's not stranger danger. These are people that children know. No, not at all. And so the world has this wrong, but they're supposed to have it wrong because then it continues to happen, right? And so I think that we've all kind of touched on that love that we had for our parents, which is hugely a part of grooming in an abused child, because if we reject their advances, what do we get, you guys? Talk to me about that, right? Because we all know what it feels like to be rejected by them, because that happens often in these homes as well. If
it's not going to go very well.
It's not going to go very well. That's exactly right. It's not going to go very well. Carol, did you have something to say?
Well,
I don't know what about.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I remember now how my father would rub my arm. And this is during the day. So I'm being molested at night. And the day, he would openly be rubbing my arm. And I thought it was just love. I mean, I really felt like, oh, you know, my father does love me and does, you know, does care about me. And of course, I'm the person, I had no memory of what was going on at night. So I had to really, you know, that makes it even more confusing. But yeah, I think as a child, you naturally need that love, that nurturing.
You do.
And so we're just drawn to that. So with the difference in power struggle or power in a home, you know, a parent is much higher than a child on the power scale. And so we're incredibly confused by what's going on. And that's very much part of that grooming. And
I think that's interesting. In Kevin's case, the other parent was not home. In our cases, Carol, it was at night usually. Sometimes when I was a young child, my mother worked and my father did not. So the same was true. But the thing that I think that's so important and why I wanted to talk about submission is because our seeking help is broken, because our ability to ask for our needs to be met is broken. Yeah. What I wanted to start a foundation of was how that carries on with us as we move into adulthood. I know for me, I was in a very abusive marriage for 18 years. And when I left him, he got cancer and he came back and he said, in front of our children, Jody, I could do anything to you when we were married. And it just made me burst into tears. But the truth is I had been, all I knew was compliance. You guys, I complied with everybody. Oh, you want to sleep with me? Okay. Oh, you want me to get drunk with you? Okay. Oh, you want me to put my head in boiling water? Okay. I had really kind of come out into life where I had no self boundaries, not even one. Not even one. So talk to me about that. That's exactly the foundation I wanted to build, because I think this is where we get stuck when we grow up. So Kevin, go ahead and start with that. And then Carol, I'll go to you.
Okay. So there's a couple of things. Once your innocence is taken, it can never be recaptured. You can't unlearn what you've already learned. And a lot of times, even unknowingly, dysfunction becomes our normal. It's our reality. Maybe you're not getting molested down the street, but here in this household, this is a regular occurrence. And when you do something over and over again, it's in your psyche. It's in your spirit. It's just what you do.
And it's our new normal. It is our new normal.
So unfortunately, I don't want to say you get used to it, but you learn to deal with it, definitely. Because what are you going to do? You're going to go live in the park?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I don't mean to laugh, but we don't have choices.
You can't get a job. You're not 18. So what?
Exactly.
You really? And then if you tell somebody, they might believe you, they might not.
Which is almost worse, actually, to tell. Yeah.
Yeah. It was very unsafe.
You're
very
stuck.
Very unsafe to speak up about really anything in our house. And interesting with my case too, is it was my mother I was so terrified of. When here my father was doing the molesting, and he was this passive, quiet personality. And my mother was terrifying. And but it didn't really matter which parent, you knew not to speak up. You knew it was totally unsafe to say anything. At least in my case. So.
Right. Kevin, what, where, how was your mom during that time? Did you, you know, where did she fit in this for the, in the grooming and the parenting? What did she look like in parenting?
So my mother was a classic mom. You know, we grew up in church. We had to go to church. She has morals and values and things like that in us. You know, I think she was a Christian woman, but I think she was also a woman that settled. And when I mean settled, she was a hard worker. She was into social things. She was like the coordinator for church. So she organized all the programs, the Easter program, the Christmas program. You know, the kids loved her. You know, she was a school teacher for over 30 years. So she was definitely, definitely empathetic. But when it came to home, it was like, whatever happens at home stays at home. And I'm not saying she condoned that, because I really don't think she knew. The only thing that I have with my mother is that my mother knew that I did not like my father. She knew that, because every chance I get, be disrespectful and all of that. And I remember one time she said, "That's still your dad." So I don't know what's going on, but that's your dad. So you can't just be, you know, talking crazy. And so, but I wanted her to ask me,
right,
specifically, is something going on with, you know, like maybe she wouldn't know it was necessarily sexual, but more, you know, I wish she would have probed into it, because it's not normal for a kid not to like their parent.
Right. And not with such disdain. Right.
I don't feel like she dug into it enough. But at the same time, mm-hmm. I was scared, because I was like thinking about the consequences. Mm-hmm. Will they get a divorce if I told her? Is she going to leave me? Going to be family outcast? So right. I think I struggle with it too, as far as just coming out clean and just telling her, and whatever right. the consequences, I wasn't strong enough to do that. So I can't put all the blame on her.
But Kevin, I have a good friend that's the head of the intake program in this area for sexually abused adults and children. And they say the same thing every day, that these children are very aware, like you were, Kevin, that the father is the breadwinner infrequently in these homes. And they know that the family will become totally unstable. They might divorce, they might split up. You might not eat, you know, if you start speaking up about this. So really, you were very sensitive about what was reality. You're very smart. And kids do this all the time. They take on a huge amount of the responsibility for what's going on when it, you know, isn't their responsibility.
It's not
at all.
It's not. And one of the things, you know, listening to this, is we own a lot. We become complicit in these things that we haven't done. People really are supposed to be protecting us, which, if you're listening, it's so important to be asking your children the right questions. Mm-hmm. I know my girls have asked their kids, and actually they've gotten some answers they haven't wanted, but at least they're asking, right? Because that's the only way that you can get there. But going back to our theme, one of the things that I love, Kevin, about your vulnerability, and Carol and I, we are all in this to be as vulnerable as we can, that the submission that was, for whatever reason, all these reasons we've talked about, whether it's because we wanted to or didn't, most of the time it was fear of punishment. It wasn't going to go well, like Kevin said. So how do we, now that we're adults and we're all older, right? We're not in our 20s and 30s. And it takes a lifetime to unlearn that training. And that, to me, if we could take the fog away from that, right? Because so many people listening, and I talk to so many people in what I do, and they're still in that stuck place, you guys. Often people actually don't enter into relationships because they have no idea how to say nope. Get away from me. Nope. Don't touch me tonight. Nope. I don't want this. Nope. We don't know how to ask for our needs. We don't know how to have any kind of boundaries with people. So how did we start? I know in my case, it took a lot of counseling to unravel who I was and get, actually, I had to go back to my story before I could ever get my voice back. What did that look like for you guys?
Well, I kind of feel like, you know, we grow up and like you say, we have no boundaries. We're horrible at setting limits. And there's a lot of luck in who you end up with, you know, or who, what kind of relationship you end up in, or no luck. But I think what happens is we keep getting in situations that don't work because we have no boundaries. And, you know, like me and maybe you're doing too, you keep taking it to the therapist and going, why isn't this working? Why is this, you know, so right. difficult? And then you slowly, slowly, hopefully learn how that you'll still be cared for if you set a boundary, hopefully.
Right. And if not, you're in the wrong relationship.
Yeah.
Right.
Or that, you know, it took me a long time to know that if I had boundaries, people would still care about me. You know, they wouldn't just discard me. I think I learned that growing up. If I said anything, I thought they'd just get rid of me. You know, my right. father was always threatening to leave me somewhere on a street corner. And,
childhood?
Yeah.
Well, that is grooming. Mm-hmm. That is grooming. Right? Fear of abandonment is a huge grooming tactic that they use.
I had huge fear of that. Yeah. He would threaten like to drop me, you know, like in LA, the middle of LA on a corner and just leave me.
Why would he say that to you?
Oh my God.
Yeah. Why would he say that to you?
I don't know. And so I knew, you know, I was little and I knew I'd have no food, no water.
Yeah.
Right.
I'd be just terrified. And I still have to work on that today. You know,
those are the things. And so, you know, I think changing our patterns can help us then do that. But each one of us, I think, understand that we hit life and all of a sudden just started complying with people, right? Kevin, talk to me about that a little bit. Yep. What did that look like in your life? Does that make sense?
So my dad, his fear tactic was if I told anybody, he would kill me or kick my butt. Mm. Yeah, right. So right. enough said right there. So exactly. The thing is,
terror.
What sent me down a road of destruction is that I equated sex and love and attention. I equated them all in the same thing. So because my sexual appetite had already been aroused as a kid, of course, when I became a teenager and a young adult, I was very promiscuous because I never knew what real love was. The closest thing that I had to love was a physical sensation. So I became very obsessed with sex because that's the only time I would feel good, sex and alcohol and weed. So I constantly medicated because it was something broken and I was trying to fix it with the things that don't fix it.
Exactly.
And so, you know, and so I lived a victim mentality. You know, a lot of people used and abused me because I wanted one thing and they wanted what they wanted. So it was a mutual abuse, I guess, in a sense.
Right. But we're still being abused. That's exactly what I'm trying to get at, because it really is when we stay in this submissive victim place.
We are being
abused. Yourself.
We abuse ourselves.
It's self-abuse at some point.
Addiction is just part and parcel of this trauma.
It is.
It's not like there was some flaw. It's not a character flaw. It's just part of it, you know? And I don't know anyone that didn't come out of a sexually abusive environment that didn't have, you know, addiction.
You know, now that you say that, I haven't either.
It's coping mechanism.
To some degree,
we have to find a way to cope. Either we put it out of our mind completely, it didn't happen, or we look for something to fulfill it when only Jesus can fulfill it. For those that believe in Jesus, only he can really fulfill it. So we're looking for natural ways to fill a spiritual void. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to leave that alone.
No, and that's okay because it's true. I always say that a mind cannot heal a broken heart. Only God can. And I really do. You know, I'm a
I agree.
Jesus girl, but it's
Yes, I
that
agree.
I think to get the pain to stop, there are no band-aids that in this world that work. There just aren't. And I've done, 20 years of counseling, but I have to tell you, every time I left that counseling office, I ran home and prayed and grabbed my Bible because that was the thing that brought logic to me and helped me with boundaries and helped me understand what love was, unconditional love, right? And so I think that's very true. I do think, yes, that we cannot heal a broken heart outside of the love of God. That's my belief anyway. However,
I do agree.
I do agree too. And I think, though, you guys, that God then calls us to help people understand what that looks like because unfortunately, there's so many people who, like I hear these people, I'm disabled, I don't get out of my house. You know what I mean? How so many people actually get themselves into a place where they're almost immobilized by childhood sexual trauma. I've seen it time and time again. Or they're absolute alcoholics and falling down in their house, or they're so obese they can't, work anymore. And so I do think it's a responsibility once we've found this. And I so appreciate that you guys are here for to talk about this because I see that the tragedy, you guys, is keeping people imprisoned. They're not, it's not that clear to them. And it's why I like to say, I think also just bringing awareness when we talk about it, you know what they're probably saying? Yep, that's exactly what I feel. And that's why I like us to articulate what the damage was that was left with us, because I think trauma and sexuality, you cannot, it's like what Kevin just said, you cannot take the two apart until you have God's help and you do real hard work about that because it affects our relationships tremendously, you guys, right? Tremendously.
And it doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Absolutely.
That we have sexual abuse going on in the family. Well, that family is very dysfunctional, is very messed up to begin with, or the sexual abuse wouldn't be there. And so all these other healthy dynamics and ways of coping and all that were not in the home, at least not in my home. So you not only have to recover from and acknowledge the sexual abuse and all the horrors that go with that, but you gotta learn and start mapping out, okay, what is healthy, what isn't, what I had to completely relearn how to have a
Boy,
family,
that's
how
true.
to raise kids in a good environment. I spent my life doing that, so.
Well, and because I think if we talk about this autopilot that we're on, and I think Kevin articulated it really well, women are not as good at about talking about sexuality, I think, as men are. I love that the bond that we had that we came what okay so our parents are abusing us constantly in childhood but now we're just going to hit adulthood and that's not that trauma and sexuality isn't going to be gone. Of course it's going to be with us. And so I can remember you guys I got married at 18 to a very abusive guy. He was very everything was sexual, of course. He was a sexual abuser. I mean, oh, I don't even want to think about the stories of what he did, but I was only married 3 months. I went out dancing with a girlfriend and then I went home with a guy because you know why? He asked me. I was 18. It was terrible, you guys. Nobody would really believe that he asked. I didn't even know how not to go with him. And so I got in horrible trouble for my husband. I never did it again because now I feared his punishment. But you know what was crazy is I was broken in the way of not saying, no, I can't go. And when I went, of course, like we know it's wrong, but you guys, there's something in us that we have a compulsion to just comply, right? Can you guys talk about that a
We're
little bit?
compliant.
One of the biggest lies is that time heals all wounds. No, it does not.
No, it
A
doesn't.
wound is not going to heal unless you dress it properly
Oh, I love that.
and give it what it needs to heal. It doesn't just heal by itself. I mean, the body does have healing properties, but you understand what I'm saying when it
I
comes to
understand.
dysfunction.
Right.
It doesn't just go away over time. Over time, sometimes it gets worse because you bury it or you just
Sedate.
dismiss it. but right? It's really not dismissed in your mind and in your heart. And so for me, one of the biggest things, which a lot of people don't talk about this, but one of the biggest things that helped me to truly get free from the trauma of it was I had to forgive my father. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. See, the spiritual things don't make sense in the natural. That's right. Why some people can't understand it. How could you forgive somebody that did something so horrible? Because I believe the Bible, and the Bible says that we have to. That's why.
Well, and talk to me about, and I'm fine talking about forgiveness. In my estimation of forgiveness, I am so thankful to forgive, because do you know what it does? It separates me from that abuser. And that's the way I look at it. I learned that I was distinctly different from them. And before I could release that forgiveness, particularly toward both my parents, hugely both my parents, but I almost felt in the ring with them until when I said, I was sorry and I forgive you for everything you've done, all of a sudden it separated me from them. I never, until I really released that true forgiveness, I didn't feel separate from them. Does that make sense to you guys?
Yeah. Excuse me. Absolutely. Oh my God. There's some adages they say, unforgiveness is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. And it's really true, because when you don't forgive, you hold yourself captive to the trauma. Oh, they did this, I'll never. So you're constantly reliving and thinking about them. They've gone on with their life.
Sometimes people
don't even know the magnitude of what they done, and they just
that
happy.
That is so true.
And you sitting up here, oh, I can't go there, I can't do this, nobody likes me, everything, you know. No.
Right.
That was then, this is now.
Right. Carol, what were you going to say?
Well, you know, I was going to say, I totally forgive my mother. And again, I had all kinds of mother issues. You know, I can totally let go of that. But honestly, I deep down really struggle with that forgiving of my father.
Right.
And
it's deep.
You know, it's deep. And at some level I do. But there's still a part of me that just can't, I just don't get it. You know, I can't imagine doing that. And him spending his entire life after I confronted him, denying that it ever happened, and he just died, you know, a couple of years ago, never acknowledged, never apologized, called me a liar, called me everything. Mm. It's very hard for me to say, oh, I forgive you. You know, that's the honest truth.
And there's nothing wrong with that. And I think last week, Kevin, we talked about what justice looks like. And when I asked the panel to describe what justice looked like, it was dead silent. Because sadly, none of us have received much justice. And I think that sometimes it's hard to forgive because we have to let it go, all of that wrong.
All of that too.
All of that wrong, right? Like if I let it go, and to me, that's why it kept close to me, because I needed it close because it wasn't complete. And it's hard to find satisfaction in saying, okay, I'm going to lay this down now. I'm done. That's a hard thing to do. When, like Kevin said, your innocence is robbed and it's never coming back. So, you know, God talks about restoration. Well, what does restoration look like when those things have been robbed at such an early age, time and time and time and time again? You know, how does that happen?
That's very interesting what you just said. It's incomplete, you know? Yeah, that's very interesting, because it's true. You don't have that. You don't have any closure. You don't have anything when that person hasn't apologized, acknowledged, or done anything. And so maybe that's what I'm struggling with.
Incomplete is really hard. You know, it's an easier example to follow, although I can follow it very easy, because when you've been raped for years as a child, that's a lot of, oh my gosh, you know, and these people never go to jail. I mean, how often do they go to jail? Never. No. But, you know, it's kind of like that lady that my father murdered that lays up in the ground. Mm-hmm. That is very hard for me to let go of. Now, while I can forgive him for that, because I didn't do it and I had no part of it, it's very incomplete for me. And I think many of us do feel that way, that our suffering isn't complete. Like, you know, where do we find comfort? All of these things. And so it makes the journey incomplete. And it's difficult to say, you know, and I don't think forgiveness does button it up and put a nice bow on it. I don't think that's what forgiveness says. For me, forgiveness just says, God, do whatever you want with them, but I want them out of my life. That's how I describe it. I don't know. Kevin, how do you describe it?
Forgiveness doesn't necessarily mean you have to trust them and have them in your life. But I will say, as a Bible believer, the Bible says, honor your father and mother, that thy days will be long upon this earth. So although I'm not happy about what he did, I know that as a Bible believing Christian, I have to forgive him. And the thing was, I will tell anybody, it was not easy at all. It was the hardest thing that I had to do, but the Lord gave me some insight on it. He said, first of all, you have to understand your father didn't have the capacity to love you properly. Your father was an abused man. And I found out that perversion runs in the bloodline, in the family. So we've never had this conversation, but by way of Holy Spirit, I truly believe that my father was violated in some way. And so he just became a product of what was done to him, because he never got any intervention. You know, he wasn't emotional. He was just a man physically, but he was messed up from the beginning. He was an alcoholic. He was a womanizer. He had all these different girlfriends, and it was just embarrassing, you know, because everybody knew. Girlfriends would pick him up at the corner, and everybody would see him, and I'd just be mortified, because outside of that, we look like the happy American middle-class family.
With the talk about the curb appeal.
And the dog.
The curb appeal,
The and curb appeal.
Your parents never divorced.
We look like the Black Bradys, but honey, we were not them, not at all. So, but back to forgiving, the Lord told me that was the key. You know, I was walking in my freedom, but it was something that just wasn't all the way there.
Yeah.
And I just asked God when I said, I'm, you know, not living that way anymore, but something is still not 100%. And he said, you have to forgive your father. So of course I said, how can I forgive him? He ruined my life. And then that's when he told me about, what's going on in the bloodline. And I had a conversation with my aunt, and we kind of put two and two together.
And those are generational curses that I absolutely 100% believe in. And they do come down. And I think my father was abused as well. And yet, you know what? I was abused, but I didn't abuse anybody. And so, you know, I think understanding also can't bring forgiveness in my heart. I mean, I tried actually that approach a lot. And it does help some. But again, not really, because I didn't do that.
It's not an excuse. It's just you have to be in the mind in order to understand something. You have to kind of be sick. You have to be discerning of where that person's mind is, because everything starts in the mind.
I think that's true. But I also think, you know, breaking these generational things, we also have to bring the truth with us loudly. And I know you're a lot about truth. You know, I mean, I think about Kevin in your life. You know, Kevin lived a homosexual lifestyle.
My father was a believer.
Whoops. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No.
My father wasn't. So his what I'm trying to say is his morals were not where my morals are. So he would do something that I would think twice about. You know, because I was raised in the Christian church. He, on the other hand, didn't really go to church. He would go, you know, once a year for Easter or something. So his whole makeup wasn't that of a godly person. So a ungodly person is going to do ungodly things. Right. So that's what I meant when I said understand him, because he was broken and he never got fixed. So right. You know, it. I'm not going to say
no, and I think that's. It's a good point.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it made it easy for me to forgive him, but it gave me more clarity as to why he did it. And I will say this, and then I'll let you guys talk. I had to be very careful because there was an incident, and I mentioned this in a former broadcast with you, where that enticement of abusing somebody else, it crossed my mind. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell the truth here. Right. This is going to help somebody. It crossed my mind. And in the moment, the Holy Spirit said to me clearly, do you want to do this to somebody's child? Do you remember how this affected you? And he also said, if you open this door, you may not be able to close it. Mm-hmm. So I thank God to this day that the Holy Spirit, even in my condition, was able to speak that to me, because only God knows where I would have been now if I would have went down that road. But it scared me, a good kind of scare, because I realized that I have to be accountable for every action, and for every action, there's a reaction. And so I made it my business never to put myself in, you know, first of all, never to listen to those ungodly thoughts, but never put myself in a situation where that would even be an option. But it scared me, because I realized that that same demon in him could have rose up in me if I would have fed it. So I do know that people that are abused, I'm not going to say, I definitely won't say all of them, but they have the potential to be abusers, because that's what's been put on your plate. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to cook if your mother only cooked you rice and beans, and that's all you know how to cook? Then what are you going to cook the next person? Rice and beans. That's all you know. Mm-hmm. Not making it right or wrong, but I'm just saying.
No,
sometimes we're just a product of our environment.
Yeah. Right, but there's choices. And see, go ahead, Carol.
Yeah. Well, you know, I also want to acknowledge that, you know, when it's the same sex parent that's being so abusive, that I'm sure that has a whole another level. You know, like with Kevin, with having a father, his role model, you know, abusing and just being a man that was abused, that takes a whole lot of courage to speak up about that. And I think there's so many men that really struggle with facing it head on and facing the reality of that. So I really appreciate what Kevin's saying. So it's hard when that's your role model has been doing that. And I think men struggle a lot with that. And I'm sure women do too. And, you know, it's a horrible, horrible.
It is. And there's a right
trauma.
I think that there are a lot more men. I actually, in my community, had a family come up to me, the wife, and said, we read your book, and I just wanted to tell you that my husband actually was abused by his father, and it's gone through the family. And a couple months later, the husband came up to me and said the same thing, and just said that they didn't stand up to their father. And then when his children were abused, the entire family protected the dad. And so, you know, this is that statistic that I quoted in the very beginning, where it said incestuous, there's 16% of families say they had a violation of incest. And yet, of all of the children who came out, you know, 46% of them said it was a close family member. So these numbers aren't accurate. And I thank you so much for saying that to Kevin, because it's so true. There's millions and millions and millions of men who have been sexually abused through incest. I know that there is, because I've personally met many of them, you guys. Many have come to me and said, Jody, my story's like yours. Or, you know, I've had gay friends that have said, don't say anything to my partner, but I was abused as well. And so you guys, there's millions of us, millions.
Yeah.
And that's exactly why we're here. And I love Kevin's tenacity to talk about everything that he does, because you're right. It takes bravery from all of us, by the way, because there's a cost to this, right? I mean, there is a cost to this. Yeah.
So the thing for me is that being a man, see, there's just so many levels and layers to this stuff. Not having a father figure, that also shaped my life. You know, I have a physical father in the home, but he never took me outside to pass a football. He never told me what it's like to date a girl, the do's and don'ts. He never instilled anything in me.
Yep.
He came home drunk. In a drunken stupor and went to sleep so he can for the night, you know, the next night. So he really didn't teach me absolutely anything. So I didn't have a male, a role as to what a man is, what a man isn't. And I began to idolize my mother. So then I took on, I'm not only dealing with the sexual, but now I'm taking on feminine traits because I want to go to the beauty shop with my mother. I want to go to the nail shop with my mother. I want to see my mother and her girlfriend gossiping and doing lady stuff. So unknowingly, I wanted to do what my mother did. So I be not only trapped up with the sex, but I became effeminate.
Wow.
My mother likes pink. I like pink. Yeah. Your mother likes shrimp fried rice. I like shrimp fried rice.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That to this is day, I love shrimp fried
rice. I don't eat it anymore, but I love it.
Yeah, I love it too.
Yeah.
You know, that Kevin, that is such a fantastic point. Do you know something I've never actually thought of is sometimes I feel like this weird vibe in my being, almost like I feel like an it. I was abused by both of my parents. And so I didn't attach to either one of them. My mom wasn't always there. There were just a handful of times that I remember, but it was violent and it left me very alone. And I despised her and I hated my father. And, you know, I don't know how to bond to anything. God, I know how to bond to God. But when you talk about that, I don't know, that was, it is kind of insightful to me because I have a really hard time bonding to anybody. You know what I mean? Like, it's like people will say, oh, I want to bond to a guy because I didn't like my dad, or I want to bond. I didn't like either one of them. So I was kind of effed out of the gate. It's been difficult for me. I never wanted, you know, to be with a woman, but I have also just wanted to be by myself because what I mean? Yeah. I didn't want to be with anybody. Very safer.
Jody, exactly. I mean, you couldn't trust either side, you know.
You can't trust,
neither mom nor father. So why would you want to trust anybody, you know?
See, and that's the thing about this that I think is so good. When we hear from people who are listening, they'll say, I just want to be part of this. Because people don't talk about these things. It's struggles. It's daily struggles to be who we are, till we can even come here and talk about and share these vulnerabilities, because it's difficult. It's very difficult. Carol, what were you going to say? I'm sorry. I think I interrupted you.
No, I think I said it, but and I think at some level I had that too. There was no trust. Well, you know, when a child cannot go to anybody to speak up about what they're actually feeling, or it does not feel safe, you're not really bonding with the people in the home. You're not bonding with the parents, you know. And I think, I think like Kevin's saying with the father, he's, you know, my mother was drunk every night, and, you know, she had no capacity, you know, to take care of us emotionally. She couldn't take care of herself, you know. And my father certainly wasn't, you know, any model of emotionally being available. So it's I can see why Kevin had a mother that was really good, so I can see why he would go right. with her.
Well, and you know what, absolutely. Right? I was close to my grandma, and my grandma smoked and gambled and drank gin. And guess what? I love to smoke and gamble and drink gin. Yes. In fact, I had a girlfriend. I said, I don't know why I like to gamble. She's like, yes, you do. It's your grandmother, the people that
See
I
See what love. I mean? It's natural.
It is.
It's natural to, you know, it's natural to take on the traits of the person that you idolize in a good way.
That's very
true. I want to be like whoever it is.
Right. Mm-hmm. But why do you see that as bad, Kevin? I'm not sure if I see that as negative, if it brought you comfort and that kind of thing, just because as a man, you know, you shouldn't have brought on those effeminate qualities. I'm not really sure. I just don't know.
Yeah. So for me, I think it was anti-man. Anti-man in the sense that men are supposed to be the leaders, the protectors. So I don't know how much of a protector you're going to be if you're effeminate like a woman. Like, that's just, I don't think personally that that's a positive characteristic of a man. But on the flip side of that, one of the issues that I have is, and I think the reason why a lot of men in particular don't come forward with this kind of stuff is because we've been conditioned that men can't have emotions. We've been conditioned that men can't cry. We've been conditioned that men can't have feelings. Oh, you acting too girly because you cry? No, Jesus wept. Mm-hmm. So since when is crying a sign of femininity? You know,
I think it's a sign of strength.
I mean, to be vulnerable, because we
have a whole bunch of angry men because they won't let their tears out, Kevin.
Because they never get to express themselves.
Yes.
They never get to cry, you know. And then the other thing is, a lot of times men try, because they've been violated, a lot of them can't accept it mentally. So they go the opposite way. Instead of being a homosexual, I'm going to be a womanizer.
Yes.
But I mean, you're still broken.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, you know, you got an apple and an orange. They're both fruit. So you're still messed up, but in your mind, you've escaped that. So you escape one, you know, one dungeon and jumped into another one. So you're still not happy.
Right.
Because promiscuity, it doesn't make you happy.
No,
only
it
in the moment.
Right. No, I used to call it like a quick fix, like a heroin fix, right? Because I mean, right. That's exactly what it is. And I can certainly understand that. I think it's very interesting when we talk about all these things, the cost to change, you guys. One of the things is people use denial, I think, is the strongest tool against not healing. And so one of the costs of coming out of denial is having to accept the responsibility of what our stories really look like. And a lot of times it's in our 30s and 40s when we say, oh my gosh, I've got to start healing here. And then the tragedy I think that people face is looking back and saying, oh my God, there's so much loss behind me, right? I haven't had children. I haven't been married. I haven't, because we just run as fast as we can to get away from the pain, to get away from the just thinking of it. So talk to me a little bit about what it feels like to actually stop and say, I'm going to do the work and the cost of that. And you don't have to go in deep detail, but I bet you guys both understand what I'm talking about.